In the scenario that you find yourself listening to the Failing Writers podcast, you should take the following steps. Remove the internal doors from your ground floor and create a shelter, ideally under the stairs. Gather up any canned foods and non-perishable items. Don't forget a tin opener. Otherwise, you'll look like a right twat. If you have children, in order to save food, and in the unlikely event of its existence to appease the Old Testament God, you should sacrifice them at this early stage. Then tune your radio to the Failing Writers podcast. This will help you appreciate that things could be worse.
Am I the only one that's felt like knocking it all on the head and never writing again this week? Or is that just me?
That's very weird you should say that, Tommy, because I have felt exactly the same, and I rarely do. I normally think my writing's great, but I...
Obviously, it's brilliant. Yeah, obviously.
No, I've like literally just can't... I can't put any words down that are even vaguely decent. And I've been reading back things. I'm in such a maunge about my writing this week, weirdly.
Yeah, I feel like someone's put little corks in the end of my fingers where the words come out.
Is that where it comes out?
Plugged your fingers up.
Do your words not come out your fingers?
You want to watch that. You want to watch that, Tom, because if it's backed up for too long, eventually it'll just come pouring out of some other orifice, won't it? Mm. Just have words coming out your elbow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is your elbow,
nobody wants
strictly
that.
Speaking, an orifice, Dave?
Well, if it bursts,
I suppose.
Yeah, it would be.
Good point.
Yeah, but I don't know why. I don't know where it's cut. It's just like like walking through treacle and just kind of like, oh, God, everyone else is having lots of success. Isn't that good for them? Way, well done.
Oh.
And just feeling like it's just massively impossible. Like, is it just some, yeah.
Well, welcome to my world, Tom. I've finally dragged you all down to my level. That's what it is.
Dave's mission is complete. There you go.
I've been really...
How do you like that, boys?
Well, I was going to say I've written a little bit, but we're talking, you know, like a handful of words. I'm really struggling at the minute, like yourself, Tom, just to get anything out.
Yeah.
I think it's... I think the problem that I'm having is that the bit of the book that I'm trying to work on is very emotionally charged.
Right.
And I'm having trouble getting myself into that sort of...
Does it feel like a lot of effort? Like it's hard work. It's like
emotionally straining
to be in the.
This is going to take a lot out of me. Yeah. So I need to get prepared.
Oh, and then
for
you start. Well, then you start trying to make a perfect space to do it in, don't you? And then that never happens. Yeah.
So I've been wondering whether I should skip this particular section, go on to the next chapter and do that, and then come back, or whether that's just...
Or whether coming back to just a page that says got written in brackets, heartfelt bit, is going to be even worse to come back to.
Yeah, get to the end and then go back to emotional trauma. I'm not sure.
I can't do that. People do that, don't they, where they leave stuff, just like go fighting scene here. I can't do that.
I wonder if I should, because it's really, I haven't done anything for ages. Because I'm just sort of staring at it.
I think maybe you need to
then,
yeah.
You need
to get past it.
Maybe I should skip it. I should just write down emotional bit, move on, you know, finish the rest of it, and then come back.
Yeah. The problem with doing that is that if you do it too much, what you find is that when you go back and read the book, it is pretty much just, one sentence. And you think you finished the book.
It's got 60,000 words, but they're all in brackets.
The amount of stuff I've gone back thinking, well, I've finished the book now, and then I've gone back and gone, that's quite a lot of chapters to actually write. But it is a way of moving forward.
Yeah, there was a really, I can't remember the guy's name now, a really famous guy, one of the most heralded Simpsons writers, wrote a lot of these most famous episodes of The Simpsons. And he had that approach, and he would write an episode, and the first draft of an episode would only have like 100 words in it, and it would all be like Homer says something stupid, and then the next bit, you know, Bart says don't have a cow, and he was like just sort of it's just a way of planning and plotting it all out, and that sort of makes sense. The problem is I've kind of gone past the planning and plotting stage, and I actually have to do the writing bit. I'm not sure I can put off the actual writing.
No, you know what has to be in there. You just haven't done it yet.
Basically. So anyway, yes, it sounds like we're all struggling at the moment.
It's a joyous opening, isn't it? That's going to people listening going, yeah, that might make people feel better, might it, that, actually?
It might.
Like cathartic, couldn't it? For
feel
them,
better about themselves.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not that shit. Brilliant.
To be fair,
could
be worse. That's kind of what we're here for.
So. Yeah, true. True.
Public service. Well, what else have we got? Have we got something that is a bit more uplifting?
Speaking of public services, if you like public services and that kind of stuff, then you might be a bit of a fan of the Scarfolk world. Tom, take over. In fact, just start the Hobbit again.
If you like public services. Oh, I do like a municipal swimming pool. No, it's not quite what we're talking about. Not
then
quite
you're
the thing with me.
Love this.
No.
Oh, I do like a big library. Again, it's not necessarily what we're talking about. No, but it does. The world of Scarfolk. Scarfolk? That sounded rude there, didn't it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it like that.
Careful.
It is Scarfolk, isn't he?
It is Scarfolk, yeah. We were debating this, but listening back to the interview, yeah. But anyway, it's a bit of a almost dystopian take on sort of the late 1970s, I guess, if you had to put a pin in it. Mm. And Richard Littler, well, you'll hear in the interview how he started off, but it's just taking that very, there's something about the public communications, isn't it, from the 1970s, have a very much a vibe and a feel and a almost their own little subgenre around them.
Yeah.
And he took that and twisted it and created the world of Scarfolk. Hey, well, thank you. Thank you for being daft enough to agree to do this. We do appreciate that.
Oh, that's absolutely fine. It sounds exactly up my alley.
Yeah, I thought that. Do you know, I'd had your book on the shelf for years. My brother had bought it for a birthday present years ago, and I'd not looked at it. It just found its way
onto the shelf and then got ignored.
Invisibly onto the shelf. Oh. Yeah, it just merged in.
That happens. And, it does happen. They do creep up on people, these copies.
I picked it up and thought, this guy must be a nutter. Let's get him on the podcast.
So, well, that sounds a fair description. I might put that on my CV, actually.
Are you, in fact, a nutter? Or, I mean, I don't know. People that aren't familiar with your work probably need to have a little look at it before listening to this interview.
Possibly, because it doesn't really make, I mean, it has its own tone and stuff. So
I think that is a very, very fair way of putting it. It has its own tone.
Well, I have to be careful. I don't want to scare too many people off straight away.
I know.
So we'll just settle on it has a tone.
I got to ask. I mean, the biggest question to ask is, where did the seed for it all come from?
It's kind of a convoluted story, really, or rather, it had a convoluted birth because none of it was intentional. You know, you spend years and years trying to write projects that you are aiming for an audience or whatever, and this one just came about by accident, and I had no control over it. So basically what happened was I was working for a German film company at the time. It was a company that specialized only in script development. So I was writing screenplays and treatments and what have you. And the company folded eventually because no one buys screenplays. So I did that for about 8 or 10 years. And at the end of it, because of course they kept all the rights to the various screenplays, I didn't really have much left. So I thought, well, I'm just going to sit down. I'm going to write a couple of screenplays. I'll write one that's a bit more commercial and one that is a bit more me, perhaps. And the commercial one, I just thought, well, you know, for want of anything else to do, I'll just send it to agents and put it in screenplay competitions and stuff, which he did. Okay, actually got into semis and quarterfinals of competitions. And the second one, which was a bit more me, I really couldn't nail down. And I knew at the time that I wanted to do something that referenced the oddness of the 1970s in Britain.
Yeah.
But I didn't really know what it was. I didn't quite know how to explain it. I didn't even know if it was personal to me and Norman knew what the hell I was talking about. So I was played around some ideas and I wrote down some story ideas and none of those really worked. And it's eventually, I realized that this tone is what we now call hauntology, which is you know, a sort of an oblique look at 1970s British life, particularly the dystopian aspects of it. But at the time, I wasn't really aware of that. And I sometimes, because I'm also a designer, I thought, well, I can't quite crack this tone that I'm aiming for, so I'm going to come up with a mood, my own mood board. So I collected lots of, you know, period images, but none of them quite caught the tone because they're genuine. So no. I thought, well, I'm just going to create some of my own graphics that reflect the time and kind of do what I'm trying to do. So I came up with four or five graphics just to try and get the thing in my head. It's, I mean, actually, it sounds very a very thorough way of doing it, but it's just my way of avoiding work. I mean, that's how I do it. If I can't, that's how I avoid writing. I pretend I'm doing something towards
but
it.
You, did you begin life as a graphic designer, Richard?
I have, yes. I mean, yeah.
Before
I kind of
writing.
Always, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
When you say begin life as a graphic designer, it sounds like you're literally born.
Literally born.
With a quill.
Oh, look, he's got a pen in. Where's he got a pen in his hand? What's he drawing now?
Where did he get that from?
He's drawing boobies. He wants milk.
Exactly. Yeah, so I've always been ever since I was a kid, I was either drawing or writing stories. So I'm not really doing anything different than I did when I was one. Mm. So, so I did these five or six images to avoid actually writing. And my wife said, well, they're quite interesting. And a few people who I knew saw them and they said, wow, that looks really genuine.
Did any of those make it through to kind of the final cut? Did they stay with it? Those images.
Well, yeah, they did. I mean, my wife said, look, I'd create these images. She said, look, they're good enough on their own. Why don't you create a little blog and put them on there? So I thought, well, I did. And I thought, well, it's sort of like, it needs an umbrella name or something, this blog. So I think I called it originally called it the Public Information Bureau of Great Britain. And I didn't really think I was going to do any more than, you know, 8 or 10 images. I didn't think it had much more mileage beyond that. And it was really the audience that decided it because, you know, I had five or six visitors over the period of 3 weeks or something. And then it went insane. I woke up one morning and 30,000 people had visited. And by the end of the month, 100,000 people had visited and I was getting calls from newspapers for interviews.
Wow. What was the catalyst for that first kind of burst of activity?
It was Twitter, I think, from what I remember. It was, you know, a couple of big names tweeted about it. Kathleen Moran was one, actually, and I remember.
Oh, right.
And it just sort of snowballed very quickly. And it's, you know, one of those classic internet viral things. And
So was that just a sharing of one of your images, one of your posters?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It was it was a fake penguin cover I've forgotten what it's called, but it's essentially about children taking hardcore drugs as a form of discipline.
Oh, yeah.
Children and hallucinogens.
Hallucinogens, isn't it? Yeah.
The future of control or something, or future of discipline. And that's what went round. And then apparently there was people writing to Penguin asking if they could get copies or if they were going to reprint it. So, you know, these little sort of stories all build up. And so suddenly I was what I thought would be 5 or 6 images or 10 just to help me out, gather the tone.
You suddenly had your own cult.
I know, well, exactly. I had my own cult. I grew a long
I've got
white
a cult.
Beard.
What should I do?
I had long flowing garments. And it was bizarre. So, and I thought, well, there's an audience here. And there's clearly interest. So I thought, well, can I come up with any more ideas? And then I went absolutely nuts, knocking out as much stuff as I could. And I suddenly realized there was a whole reservoir in my head of this stuff and I actually couldn't keep up with it.
I was going to say, it's weird, isn't it? Almost that, that's like vindication and right, that's fine then. If you like this, I've got plenty more where that came from.
The thing is, I didn't even know I had it there in my head.
And, right.
And it's, you know, I turned procrastination into a job. Right, and so the main project didn't happen. It never came about the same way.
That's the dream. Yeah. There's a strong anti-establishment slant to your work, which I really like, but it's kind of like a sort of satirical keeping the ruling powers in check by exaggerating some of their more egregious ideas. But was that something that developed, or was that something that is it like a little burning flame inside you, or, you know, how did that progress?
I wasn't particularly political at all. I mean, I wasn't interested. I was just interested in reading books and watching films most of my life. So I wasn't political. But when I was doing the research in the first months of Scarfic, I suddenly noticed that there were quite a lot of parallels with contemporary current affairs. And I thought, well, I may as well comment on the 2015 stuff or 2014, whatever it was at the time, by using the 1970s. And so sort of having a spiritual connection between the two, or a supernatural connection between the two. So it came out of that, really. And also because, you know, it was, as I suspect, and I said, I only had 5 or 6 images originally. Yeah, there's only so many just surreal things for the sake of it you can do. And it needed to have a sort of a live appeal to it. So it meant that once a week I could comment on what happened in the previous week by mixing the two time periods.
Brexit, in a way, was a gift, wasn't it, to a certain extent?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was a gift, but it also damaged a lot of satire because, you know, you couldn't make that shit up, you know. And
Brexit and Trump kind of ruined an awful lot of satirist careers, didn't it? And
just... Well, that's the thing. I had to, if you look at some of the early Scarfix stuff, I had to start, you know, turning up the absurdity to 11 because I was competing with with real life.
Mental,
you know,
things happening.
I guess there's a theory knocking around that we are living in a simulation, and it would appear that you might be the number one.
You're writing it.
Yeah, you could be.
I might be
it,
God.
Richard.
I might be God of everything.
You might
since
be.
2015.
That's what I mean. It's possible.
I mean, I must admit, there are a few times when I have thought, "No, that is just weird," because I only said that 2 weeks ago. But you know, but then again, you know, the government was keeping a close eye on Scarfix proceedings. You know, I know that Michael Gove and James Cleverly were following Scarfix, and it was odd that you know, 2 or 3 weeks later you would see, you know, a government ad, and it had sort of fake old paper, and it looked with the 70s font, and I'm like, hold on a second, who's supposed to be, you know, aping who here, you know? But we also have the which was one of the highlights of Scarfix, was when the government released one of their own magazines and on the history of public information. Governmental public information, and among the reproductions of posters, of genuine posters, an accidental Scarfix one had slipped in. And I mean, that went, so there was no distinction. I mean, they obviously, someone couldn't make the distinction between.
That's wonderful. What was it?
Oh, it was about not hesitating in shooting your child if it has rabies.
I mean, that's fair enough, actually, because that was quite a big thing in the 70s.
That, I mean, that's just sensible.
Well, exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
If it's his, it's sensible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they got that went viral as well.
Wow. One of my favorite Scarfix public information posters is immigrants are taking the crimes normally committed by British criminals. UK-born offenders are losing their constitutionally entitled places in prison, and their way of life is under threat.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it's you know, it's, I guess, probably around the beginning of the whole anti-immigrant thing, at the beginning of Brexit campaign, I think.
My favourite is less controversial, I think, in terms of subject matter. But it's the kitchen idea and advert about having your children surgically adapted and genetically bred to have KitchenAid products for limbs.
Well, you know, I wasn't even joking there. I mean, sometimes, sometimes I will just tell the truth, and I think it's a good idea.
I think there was an element from my advertising background of just hearing that as a full multimedia campaign.
Yeah.
I could hear it across radio, I could see the TV ad.
Well, that's exactly what I do when I'm creating this sort of thing. I'll create the ad for it, and I'll, you know, so it's, I do try to stay as close as I can to how it would be dealt with.
We used to work in advertising, writing radio ads. Would we have your permission to make a radio ad of the kitchen to play now in the podcast?
Why not?
We live in a world of modern convenience, from the magic of speaking down the telephone line, to computers small enough to fit into a single room, to folding stools, asbestos-laminated pamphlets, and indoor flushable toilets. But while the world around may be an impressive technological utopia, are you getting the most from those nearest and dearest to you? Introducing KidChen. Always trying to get your children to give you a hand in the kitchen? Well, now they can, with a much better one. Upgrade your progeny today to an improved, newer, more helping version of themselves by simply risking the surgical attachment of a useful kitchen utensil or appliance to one of their wrists. Your child could be upgraded with the addition of a whisk, spatula, mixer, cheese grater, potato peeler, egg slicer.
I've got a whisk for a hand now. It doesn't always hurt, and I think it makes mummy love me.
Starting from just £12.50 per limb, transform your kid into a kitchen. And right now, get one child modified and receive a set of steak knife fingers completely free.
Free.
Kitchen. Available now from your stockist. Hurry, while favourable laws last. Cheese grater implant not recommended for children who are going through puberty. Do not leave kitchen childs near strong magnets unless doing so for a laugh. Bread knife attachment temporarily unavailable due to the incident.
What is it about things that we grew up with that seem to have a very powerful impact? Because anything like anything that's a little bit hauntological like that, you know, things that exploit like cultural memory, especially things from your childhood, they just seem to, I don't know, resonate somehow. What's that about, do you think?
You know, I don't know. And I'm not entirely sure. I wasn't sure if other generations have had what, you know, we kids of the 70s had had. But then again, actually, you know, when I did my research for the 70s, I noticed that there was quite a preoccupation with stuff from the 1930s.
Right, okay.
So there's always, this 30
yeah,
or 40.
Yeah, we're always going
year.
Back a few years.
No, I think that's, I think with the nature of that kind of government communications, it obviously does kind of come out of World War One, probably initially starting, then really peaking World War Two, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And this was almost a continuation of that kind of, your big government tells you to do this, be safe, kind
well,
of
exactly,
idea.
Exactly. The whole Kitchener, you know, Kitchener ad. Mm.
And now we live in a much more separated out media environment, don't we? Everyone's got their own little echo chambers to sit in.
But one of the important things about the changes is that what makes the 70s and before so odd is that you can play with people's memories because you don't have access to the source material anymore. So you can fill it. So basically what I did when I started Scarf was I realized that people would have memories of the 60s, 70s and early 80s, but they couldn't confirm whether or not it was genuine.
Yeah.
So what I did was I gave people things they recognized and then turned them on their head. So I twisted their memories of what, you know, and whereas nowadays kids go, well, I can look it up on YouTube anytime. But, you know, when I was a kid, you think, well, I saw this strange program and I think I may have only seen it once, or did I dream it? And that's where Scarfock comes in. Scarfock says, no, you didn't dream it. And it was actually much worse than you thought. Whereas now you check it on YouTube. Everything's filed. Everything's hard. Nothing decays anymore because it's all digital. So that's another big reason for the interest in that period, I think.
Your source material, Richard, I have this image in my head of a room in your house housing a vast collection of old government posters and propaganda and kids' books and, you know, stuff. Do you have that? Do you have a collection, or do you just find stuff on the internet? What's your research like?
Well, I've got a few bits and pieces here, but I've moved around a lot, so I don't keep a lot of stuff that I don't need. But so most of my stuff that I sort of my archive, as it were, is digital. And I think I've got 25,000 images separated out into various subject areas that I sort of use as and when I need them.
And that's come from all different sources, like lots of government sources?
Everything. I mean, I keep everything from Argos catalogues to, you know, to sweet wrappers, you name it, and I've got everything that was available culturally in one form or another, you know.
And what's happening in Scarfock right now, then?
Nothing's really happening at the moment. We had quite a period, since the annual came out, there was quite a period, intense period of pitching, because it had been optioned a long time ago. So there had been TV development pitches and then radio and blah, 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 and some merchandising thing. And so that took up a lot of time. And neither was successful, unfortunately, although pretty close. So that took up a lot of time. Then there was someone was interested in book three, but just after we'd left the EU properly. And it really affected the publishing industry, because a lot of books, particularly books with images in, were printed abroad. Because it was cheap.
Oh, the irony.
You know, well, exactly. And so what happened is, I didn't even have to pitch it. I was approached by the publisher, and they said they really wanted to do it. And then when they ran it by the finance department, they said, we just can't afford to make as many image-based books as we used to. So Brexit killed Scarfock Book 3 for the time being. It's just harder to get anything made nowadays.
That was the government's plan the whole time.
Of course it was,
Richard.
Of course it was. They told me as much.
They finally kill Scarfock off.
They don't like people muscling in on the dystopia, you see.
No, exactly.
But yeah, so lots of things have happened. And then I decided to have a break about a year ago. So I've been writing a novel.
Oh, wow.
And, which I've almost finished.
Tell us a little bit about that. No, you can't skip over that. Come on.
Tell
us about your novel.
Because I'd spent so long working with screenplays, you know, I kind of was sick of the three-act structure. It would just killed me, you know. So when I did Scarfolk, I am leading up to that, by the way. When I started Scarfolk, it was very liberating because I decided that from the beginning that it was going to be completely improvised. Mm. And so I would wake up every Thursday morning with no idea. And by 3 o'clock online, there would always be a post and an image. Mm. And because I really enjoyed that and I found it much more productive than rigidly outlining the 3X structures that you have to do for treatments and pitches and what have you. I thought, well, I'm going to try to mix the two for this novel I'm going to write. So I decided to have more of an improvisational approach to it without worrying too much about structure, which I presumed, I was hoping that it was so ingrained in me by now that I wouldn't necessarily have to rely on it as much because it would be there. Mm. So I improvised it, deciding I was going to write as much as I could and then do what Eisenstein did. I could take all the available material at the end and edit it into whatever it was going to be. And so I improvised so that I wanted the story to reveal to me what it was about. I wanted to know what, you know, I didn't want to start out with any preconceptions about theme or tone or what it was about. And I thought, I'll just let it reveal itself to me. And
what about genre? Did you have, was it a sort of similarly dystopian kind of feel to it, or did you have no idea, no expectations at all?
Zero, absolutely zero.
Right.
And I just thought, well, what do I feel like writing about today? Mm. So I did that. And very slowly but surely, over the period of 2, 3, 4 months, I realized I was writing about something that I hadn't realized it. So, you know, it presented itself. So then from then on, I sort of focused targeted my focus a bit more. But it's fake nonfiction. I mean, it appears to be a book of nonfiction, but it isn't.
So it's recognisably you, in
no
a sense.
Well, I'm not sure. Okay. Well, it is in that sense, but it's absolutely no humour in it at all. Mind you, a lot of people think right, having a humour either. So it depends who I'm talking to when I pitch it.
Wow, it sounds intriguing.
But no, I'd been reading a lot of plotless books for the last few years, 2 or 3 years at least. So a lot of Sebald and Olga Tokarczuk, and going back to Proust, and lots of sort of creative nonfiction like Bruce Chatwin and Werner Herzog and you name it, that kind of thing. So, and I was just so liberated to read things that weren't, you know, restrictive three-act structures, you know, which are just tiring, you know.
And has anyone read it yet?
No, I'm still structuring it. I wrote it in chunks, and then I need to sort of intertwine the various elements, which I'm doing right now, and I hope to have it done by the end of the year latest. And then it's completely uncommercial, unmarketable, and no one's going to publish it. And but that, you know, what can I say?
Who knows? That's what I say about everything I write as well. But yeah, no, it sounds intriguing.
Well, this is the thing, you know, I had no idea Scarfolk was going to happen. You know, things find an audience or they don't. You can aim to or not. It makes no difference.
The next train from platform 13 is the 10:75 to Scarfolk, calling at Mange, Gravely,
Gillingham Common,
Gurnton, and Skankfirth. Please proceed to your carriage immediately, avoiding eye contact. If you see anything suspicious, including people emitting a general sense of foreignness, jeggings, or incompetence, please report it to one of the disciplinary enforcement agents at the Silence Plaza.
When you were growing up, what was the era, age, time, era, decade that you were growing up in?
I was born in 71. So
you've got the full 70s effect.
Yeah. I got the full thing.
What in your formative years then, other than obviously all the government propaganda, what kind of shaped your writing, your worldview in terms of what were you reading? I guess that would be an easier way to ask that 20-minute question. What did you read when you were a kid?
Well, you know, it's the 70s, so it's the supernatural. Everything was supernatural.
Right.
Whether it was comics, you know, you've got Shiver and Shake comics, or you've got Actually, I didn't read that. I didn't know why I said that. I gave it as an example because I'm used to be an example, but I never read that at all.
What did you actually read? That, just tell us the truth. What, God.
Okay, I see. Oh, it's embarrassing. No, I read Argos catalogues. No, I read Marvel comics. I read loads of Marvel comics, Spider-Man, that kind of stuff. Enid Blyton when I was a little kid. But then I had a problem when I was a little bit older because I have ADHD.
Right.
And so what happened was I could get through at least four words without wandering off mentally. And so it became a little bit tougher the older I got. And I didn't really return to reading again until I was sort of in my early 20s.
Really?
And but when I was a little kid, I collected loads of stuff. I mean, loads of horror stuff, lots of the gothic stuff, Dracula, Frankenstein, that kind of thing. But also there was this great outpouring of sort of really sensationalist, so-called non-fiction, but not very scientific, of, you know, Loch Ness monsters, UFOs, ghosts, all that kind of thing. So I had loads of that.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of that. But I'm not sure that sort of influenced one part of Scarfuck, I guess, but obviously I was also interested in the sort of dystopian side too. But, you know, obviously Orwell was an influence. And, God, what else? I liked War of the Worlds. You know, I loved that sort of a part of that. So I guess some science fiction, I suppose, but not too much. You know, I'm a massive Star Wars fan as a kid. And Ray Harryhausen and all that kind of thing. I was more of a film watcher, actually, when I was small.
These days, Richard, do you do much commission work? Or do you get to be quite choosy about what you do? In terms of like illustration and design?
No, I do take illustration work. I mean, if it's something I really don't want to do, I won't. But you know, a lot of my stuff comes from me doing stuff on spec. So I'm much more interested in doing my own things and somebody else wanting it rather than being commissioned. Because what always happens is, you know, whether it's writing, filmmaking, illustration or whatever, people come to you and they say, we want something that only you can do.
Yeah.
And that's what we want. So then you go away, you do it, and they go, yeah, but not like that. Can you do it more like...
somewhere in between.
Yep.
So sometimes I take things on and sometimes I don't. But I mean, for example, today I was just fiddling around yesterday creating a fake medieval woodcut and and I posted it of a plague doctor with a hand puppet and I posted it online. And then, you know, within a few hours, I got a call from editor of American Bystander magazine. He said, can we have it? So that's how I like to do things.
Is this an actual woodcut or is this kind of a photoshopped created illustration of her, if you know
it's,
what I mean?
Well, it's I use at the moment, well, it's I'm using drawing software at the moment, and I created a template for myself so that you basically have to treat it the same way as if it was a woodcut, with the same sort of cuts and nicks out or something. Brilliant. With one layer of black and white, and it's basically it was a test one, because I want to go and do a proper woodcut, you know.
I see.
Wow. So I gave myself a trial run on it. And I often trial things out first in software, you know.
Tom's going to be annoyed with me for bringing this up. Tom has written an extremely funny book, which is basically just sat there in a drawer and has been for quite a while. It's like it's basically a parody sales manual, how to be the greatest salesperson.
Yeah.
Written by this, self-professed sales guru.
Yeah.
And he's a salesman who's like a little bit stuck in the 90s. You know, he just gets everything a little bit wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And I keep trying to persuade Tom that he should get an amazing illustrator involved and turn it into a really beautiful item. Do you know what I mean?
Like a
proper Christmas
objects.
Gift.
Yeah.
So it looks, you know, it almost looks authentically a bit naff.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, exactly.
It could be completely, you know, legit as well.
Yeah.
And I feel like it should have sort of bizarre illustrations about how to shake people's hand properly.
Yeah, yeah, you know, exactly.
In order to, to dominate them in a sales situation or how to
trouble
wear
is,
your
you
hair.
You can't get books like that printed these days, James.
Well, that's
very true. That's very true.
Everyone knows that.
Everyone knows that, mate. Yeah. It's obvious.
Everyone knows that. Idiot.
Tom is currently, he's very resistant at the moment, but I feel like if I was to get someone to mock something up for him, he'd absolutely love it.
Well, no, you see, this is your idea.
But it's not really. It's not necessarily my idea. There would be your ideas in it. It would just look really good. Or my idea is just, it should look good. It's as simple as that. But how would you go about finding an illustrator to work with? You know, someone that you feel has a similar sense of humor, or, you know, is there like a designer illustrator database? I don't know how it works, really. How do you find someone?
Well, I've seen, but there are agencies, but there's one of the things that's interesting is every year or twice a year there's a day when designers and illustrators just call, I can't remember what it's called, like hashtag portfolio day or something like that. And sometimes it's worth just, you can just scooch down and just see so many illustrators, you know, and they're all available for work, you know, and that's a really good way of doing it. But it's very hard to just go out and find, you know, that's the thing, you know, illustrators, you know, they're looking for, I do pen and ink or I do watercolors, but you're looking for someone who is, you want someone with a certain kind of way of thinking as well.
That's right. That, a similar way that you think, basically, Richard.
Well, I'm available for work, so that's that sorted.
Well, that's good.
You know, because I do specialise in producing work that is, quote, slightly naff to look at. So I can do that, you know.
Oh, well, there you go, Tom. There you go. Think about
brilliant.
It.
No, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, John. That's great.
Yes, I knew you'd be pleased. So your notebooks, I'm guessing your notebooks aren't like full of story ideas.
Oh, God.
So much as like, what would they be? Like little just ideas about things.
Yeah, I mean, I've got, God, I mean, seriously, I mean, I could probably produce a book the size of a house just with, you know, log lines and paragraphs and synopses and pitches and treatments. And I mean, I'm always having ideas and there's just no way you could, even if you dedicated a year to each of the ones, the best ones that you think could work, you know, I would never be able to do them all, you know. But you know, but then again, this novel wouldn't have happened if it hadn't have been for medication, because you know, I've been trying to finish novels for years, and when I got diagnosed with ADHD and autism, and they said, well, you try this tablet, it'll help you focus. And I thought, well, I don't see how. And I took it, and then I have a novel now in a year. So
oh my
it's,
God. It, what is that stuff?
It's basically it's speed to break it down. But it's a certain kind of thing, variation of it that works with people with ADHD.
Right.
And it just triggers a certain part of the brain to actually work.
To keep you focused.
Well, exactly. We have it's called the noisy classroom syndrome. So what happens is, you have a bunch of noisy kids throwing stuff across the room and making loads of noise, and the teacher at the front is asleep. So what you do is you take a stimulant, and all it does is it wakes the teacher up, and then it brings calm. So it's a stimulant that calms you down, basically.
Right. Yeah.
And so it just means that I can focus for longer, and
that's fascinating.
Or even at all. But fortunately, if you haven't got ADHD, it won't work. So
yeah.
It's so I'm not recommending.
Hey guys, amphetamines.
Exactly.
The way forward.
You don't do drugs, kids.
So it turns out that my very first scarf at Poke, Children and Future of Discipline, is actually correct. It does actually work.
Full circle. Wow.
And now, here's government approved song 56.
Don't be silly or emotional. Simply use a little self-control, then we'll all avoid the rigmarole of being locked up in the stinky hole. Remember, love is inconvenient, and the arts are just for deviants. The state cannot be lenient on that kind of disobedience. So come on, let's have fun on the government's casino app. You could win a nice thing like a brand new cowboy hat or a cat.
There was something else I wanted to ask you, Richard.
Yeah.
So some of the elements of the satire and parody in Scarfic are quite close to the bone, or could be seen as mildly controversial in places.
Mm-hmm.
What was the censoring stroke filtering process like for publication?
Well, it became increasingly difficult, actually, because when I first started, I wasn't particularly cautious.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Because it was only for inside of my head, basically.
Yeah.
First of all, it always had to be, the government had to be the butt, or the controlling culture had to be the butt of the joke. And if I did touch on a subject that was touched on, either, you know, racism or sexism or know, any of the isms of the 70s, it had to be, if the, for example, if it was a sexist joke, or rather it was based on a sexist joke, and women were obviously treated badly in the post, the joke was about how the government had brought that about, or rather how society had brought that about, and more so how the government or the culture took it for granted and didn't even think it was an issue. So I had to do it. Now, there have been a couple of times where I've done something inadvertently. So, for example, I did one about Nazis, and I said that, I can't remember exactly, but I said something along the lines of, you know, you can't blame Nazis, it's not their fault. They've had a lifetime of, I can't remember what it was, learning difficulties, I said. Now, I didn't. Now, that caused some problem because, you know, they thought I was associating people with learning difficulties with Nazism. Now, the problem is, because I haven't lived in England, I ended up doing some research. I talked to a psychiatrist or a counsellor about it, who said that phrase, learning difficulties, has really only come into common parlance since I left the UK. So I wasn't really aware of it. And when I actually wrote the post, I was careful not to use... I was trying to be careful not to use terms that I thought might be seen as offensive. So when I found out that someone very politely wrote to me, I didn't get any of the Twitter aggression, but someone politely said, look, I've got learning difficulties, and I don't know if you're aware, but that's, you know, a sensitive term. And that's when I went out and did my research, and I looked back and I thought, well, that's absolutely fine. And they changed it, you know, because, you know, primarily, obviously, I don't mind offending people, but it also distracted from the joke. You know, it stood out like a sore thumb as well. So I thought, well, it's detracting from the joke when I make about Nazis. So then I re-edited that. And I've done that a couple of times, but simply because a lot of the time it's inadvertent, or it distracts, or but most of the time I've had no problem. I mean, most people understand what I'm doing, and they don't take offense. And sometimes people, when a subject is close to the bone, people have sometimes written to me who are affected by that kind of joke, or not affected, but it involves them, it's about them. They have written to me just to say, just so you know, I'm this, whatever it is, and I thought it was hilarious. So, right. you do get that as well.
But.
I have wisks for hands, and I'm fine with it.
Well, exactly. Well, that's
although it has taken me a while to write this letter to you.
You won't believe me, Hal, how many emails I got from that one. People with whisks and ladles my aim is not to be an edgelord, you know. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in genuine satire, and I'm not interested in shock value. It doesn't really interest me.
So how much did end up on the cutting room floor from that sort of thing in with the publishers then, or was it a relatively smooth process?
I probably, in the entire career of Scarf, at 7 words got cut. There was the first book, they published it as is, not a single word was changed.
Wow.
And that I remember anyway. And then the second book, we agreed that it was already getting too long, and there was one chapter in the book that was perhaps not on the edge, but slightly repetitive of what I'd already done. And it was because it was slightly edgy anyway, we both just thought, me and the editor just thought, well, we'll just cut that, you know. But otherwise, it's been, I haven't really had any problems. Because, I mean, I'm trying to be sensitive to the, you know, to the what Scarfic is. It's got its own, you know, once you define the world like that, it has its own rules anyway.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, in a weird kind of way.
So you can't, once you've created that quiet sort of distant government voice, you can't really go beyond that. You can't really start insulting people, because, you know, the government wouldn't want to either. So, you know, once you have that voice,
their offense is all accidental, isn't it?
Exactly. I've been trying to imitate that inadvertent but tone deaf clumsiness. Exactly.
It's a great excuse, isn't it, for turning out tone deaf clumsy work.
I specialise.
It's a way forward. No, it's meant to be like
but
that.
I did get quite a few people who would say, let's just say they're on the more extreme right of the political spectrum, who were disappointed to find out it was satire, basically. So that caused me some issue, because, you know, I didn't want it to be indistinguishable from, you know, actual extremist rhetoric, you know. I did, so it's, you know, you feel slightly disappointed when someone who comes to you who's really right wing says, yeah, you're absolutely right, we really should cut kids' hands off.
Yeah, well, I guess that does tie together Nazis and learning difficulties, doesn't it?
For the joke to work, though, it has to be close, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's it does thing. Have to be close.
It has to be really close to the line.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it's about just getting that tone right. And it's different for everybody. I mean, one of the problems you run in when you do pitches for TV and film stuff is, you know, everybody's line in the sand is somewhere else. And so it's difficult for get everyone to agree where that line is, especially when you've got, you know, producers and commissioners and co-producers. And when I do it on my own, it's just me. So it's, I know where the line in the sand is, and I hope I don't overstep it. And but yeah, it becomes difficult when you deal with other people. So everyone's different.
Well, thank you ever so much for your time, Richard.
Not a problem. So I don't often do these things, but it was nice to do.
I felt like I had to ask you after feeling guilty for leaving your book on the shelf for that long.
Exactly. Well, have you read it yet?
Oh, yes.
You have read it now, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's good. Fully read.
Fully read.
It didn't take me very long, actually, which is unusual. I'm not a massive reader, so
No,
I guess the pictures helped. Do you know what I mean?
Well, exactly. Well, that's what
it moves things along, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Pop-up would have been...
Yeah, that's more my style.
The first book is just... I'm really not happy with it, from between you and me and everyone who's listening, obviously. But it was very rushed. You know, Scarfoot was very young. I mean, I got a book deal within 3 months of Scarfoot starting. So, and people didn't know, publishers didn't know whether it was going to have a life beyond Christmas. You know?
Right. So it was literally strike while the iron's hot.
Exactly. Mm. So... I mean, I wrote the entire book in 3 months.
With the illustrations and everything, presumably.
No. I had a 6 month schedule, 3 months on the graphics, 3 months on the text. And so I think you can tell. I mean, that's, you know, you shouldn't be knocking out a book in 3 months. I mean, it's got, you know, I'd love to be able to go back in and expand and, you know, make it a bit more nuanced and build on it. So. But, you know, if someone offers you a book deal and you take it, you know.
Go massively diva artist and go, no, this doesn't fulfill my vision.
Exactly.
I need at least 3 years to... Yeah, cheers, mate. See you later.
I only write in the autumn.
Yeah.
So I could have done with another year on that or something, you know, just to get it to be where it really wanted to go. And it's actually an adapted treatment for the screenplay I was working on, so it's kind of like an illustrated treatment in a way, but I'd like to be able to redo that at some point if I can be bothered. someone pays me.
Gives hope for all of us that if it was just, you know, if you feel like a bit of a rushed fudge that published well. That's what,
if that was a fudge, you
know.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, but it's...
some might argue that any of that rawness and roughness would actually add to that, though.
Yeah, perhaps.
Actually becomes part of it and is actually gives that kind of... Because it has got that sense of giddy movement through it.
Actually, giddy is probably a good way of describing it. I think you're probably right. I sort of wrote it in a fever pitch. And that's... Yeah, because I didn't really have time to sort of smooth it out and sort of...
But that slight dizziness and out of focusness.
Yeah, slightly mad.
And it gets to the... Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe it works.
So don't go ruining it.
Don't go spoiling it. Leave it. No, maybe everyone should do that. Book in 3 months.
Yeah.
Three books a year. 4 books a year. There you go.
Well, thank you very much, Richard.
No problem.
That was a good little addendum, that, wasn't it? I enjoyed that bit. If you have a photograph or image that you would be happy for us to use as a cover shot, whether that's something Scarfoaky or your face,
I just did an illustration of me yesterday, so you could have that.
Oh, that'd be brilliant. That'd be perfect.
Okay.
That'd be absolutely perfect.
I will send you that in a minute.
Oh, that sounds good.
All good. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Cheers.
Cheers,
bye.
Richard.
Bye.
Cheers. See ya.
I'm really sad that I missed that one, chaps, because that sounded as though it would have been right up my alley.
Yeah, I think you would like the whole Scarfoak thing.
Yeah.
Books, you should get hold of one. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I love the sort of public service broadcasts from when we was kids. There was something really haunting about a lot of them.
There were people have been scarred for life by the train one. Don't walk on the train lines.
Yeah.
It's like little mini horror shows.
There was.
And the kite one as well.
Oh, God, Jesus. So I forgot about that. Yeah, the The pylons.
Yeah.
Do you remember the one? I've never been able to find anyone who's remembers this. It was the message was, don't leave glass bottles on walls because small children might cut themselves. Do you remember that one?
No.
So it was a little girl walking along a road, dragging a stick along a fence. So it was going, she walked along, and then it kept like cutting to a glass that had been left on a corner, and then cut back to a glass on a corner, back to a, and then suddenly she accidentally knocked the glass onto the ground and tripped. And then, as they did a lot in these videos, it would freeze frame.
Oh, did yeah, you used to
just
didn't
hear
it?
The scream.
Yeah.
Echo and then
don't leave
like,
glass
don't
bottle.
Leave glasses on walls.
It's like a GCSE drama piece. Yeah.
But you're right, they always did freeze, didn't they, at the moment when everything got
really
a bit nasty.
Yeah.
It's like a, and you just see a close up of the kid's face.
Yeah. And to this day, I've never left a glass on a wall.
That was a real problem though, so down your way, wasn't it? In Bristol. It wasn't such a problem
in Yorkshire,
as so it's probably quite specific to your
centre
area.
The centre for leaving glasses on walls.
The people in Yorkshire were too busy taking them back to get the penny back from the wall.
That's true, yeah.
Not leaving that on
that
a wall. You take that back for a penny.
Melt it down, yeah. So, yes, but that was a thoroughly pleasant interview, chaps. Well done. Sorry to have
Thank
missed
you.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And before we go today, we've got another work in progress from one of our listeners, haven't we?
We have. I don't know how work in progress it is, but...
well, it's a completed story, really, isn't it? To be fair, it's a story in its own right. This is from Madeline Postman.
Who... I really like the fact that she had to follow her name in brackets by saying, yes, that is my real name, which, I like that.
I also liked her email, how she said, because I quit my day job to listen to episode 1 of season 4, I think the least you can do is pick apart Data Double until I cry. Please find it attached. So with that said, boys, let's have a little listen to Data Double before we pick it apart and make Madeline cry.
Data Double by Madeline Postman. Arabella never imagined she'd end up here, on the espresso brown leather sofa in her boss's 32nd floor flat. It was the porter who'd called her. Arabella had no idea she was Erin's emergency contact. He had found Erin's body after a fire alarm had alerted him, her last time ruining a frying pan. The first indications pointed to a brain hemorrhage. Arabella had funneled her shock into a to-do list. From outside her body, she watched herself shift into high gear. She also never imagined meeting Stephanie.
Call me Steph, please. I've heard so much about you.
But here they were, thigh to thigh, sorting out labyrinthine paperwork. Arabella was disappointed that Steph, even allowing for the shock of her sister's death and her arrival straight off a red eye from San Francisco, shared none of Erin's glamour. Arabella had imagined it running in the family, and it made her miss Erin even more to realize that it was so special to her. Steph seemed unmoored, trying to use her phone as an anchor into normal life. From her muttering, Arabella gathered that she was following her boy's routine at home, 8 hours behind UK time.
Steph?
Yeah?
Steph glanced up, brushing her lank hair behind an ear.
I found out about something called the Tell Us Want service. It seems to be the one thing the shit show of our government has got right. You register the death and they inform HMRC for taxes, the passport office, the DVLA for her driver's licence. Did she have a UK driver's licence? The council for council tax. I don't know how Erin's dual citizenship will affect things. And I'm afraid you're going to have to do a lot of this rigmarole. But let me know if I can help.
OK.
Steph responded weakly, looking bewildered by the foreign alphabet soup. Her phone chimed and she went back to staring at its screen. She scrunched her eyebrows together.
What? I just got an email to say that Erin has a data double. What's that mean?
She pronounced it data rather than data. Oh, shit. Arabella looked down on the City of London, noticing how the light bounced at various angles off the array of glass towers.
You know, like a digital twin? It can automate workflows, simplify tedious things, all in your own style. I set it up for her last year.
Can you set up a data double for someone else? Did she ask you to?
Yes, of course.
No, of course not.
I can't imagine her giving up control like that. She hated those amorphous companies owned by some white male trillionaire who's in bed with governments all over the world.
A crescendo ended with a bang. Arabella concentrated on keeping her voice even.
Well, she asked me to set it up, so I did.
As the countdown began, Arabella joined an impromptu huddle, and the four of them jumped up and down in Negroni-fueled excitement.
3, 2, 1! Happy 2029!
The Lebanese architect broke free and waved her hands in the air, whooping, her black hair as crazy as Medusa's snakes. Arabella wouldn't have been surprised if the woman had jumped into the Shoreditch House rooftop pool fully clothed. The Italian furniture brand owner kept his arm around Erin's shoulders, attempting to stake his claim. Arabella and Erin locked eyes, grinning. Ooh, I've got a definite girl crush. The two women had just met that evening, after Arabella's friend had gone missing in the crowd. He'd probably found a hunky hookup for the night. Arabella didn't mind, since that's when the smiley brunette noticed that Arabella was on her own and gestured for her to come over. Something transcended Erin's prettiness. Maybe it was her Californian energy mixed with London refinement. Arabella thirsted to stay in her orbit. She hoped that Erin would remember the out-of-the-blue job offer once she was sober. Arabella didn't intend to become Erin's puppeteer. The early days were insultingly easy, micromanaging her boss's calendar, bundling up receipts that gathered like autumn leaves in the corners of the office, calling editors to get Sapphire PR's clients featured in the best glossies. Arabella was the perfect remedy for Erin's scattiness. All the while, Arabella fell in love with the work. Each photo shoot she organized attracted her more and more to the beauty of matter, the silken touch of oiled hardwood, the visual delight of sleek architectural forms, a sheepskin rug that, when she snuck a moment to curl up on it, made her feel like a joey in its mother's pouch. Beside a stream of interns who did the legwork, Erin quickly got rid of the entitled ones and kept the hard workers until they found better pay elsewhere. Sapphire PR was just the two of them.
How did I live without you?
Erin asked more than once, with her earnest New World honesty. That question was Arabella's greatest reward, certainly more satisfying than her earnings, which, like the interns, were humble, though Erin had promised frequent salary reviews. Before long, Arabella was running the firm's social media accounts. It was her face that opened the authenticator for multi-factor authorization logins, and Erin had given her the master password for the app that stored all the other passwords. Every time Arabella signed in somewhere, she'd get a prompt. Want to set up your data double, Erin? Arabella was tempted. The data double would make her life so much easier, like having Erin at her side, but in a more reliable digital form. One day, she gave in. She rushed past all the caveats about autonomy, jurisdictions, and legal responsibilities. Under next of kin, Arabella wrote in Stephanie's name and email address. How naive that she uses her birth year in her Gmail. Erin never found out about the data double that supercharged Arabella's work. She did notice her assistant's detailed editorial calendars and perfectly on-brand copywriting. Erin bubbled,
"This is all wonderful, Arabella. Don't worry about checking anything with me anymore.
You're fabulous. You're better than me at being me."
So I've got a question for you. Firstly,
go on.
Mm-hmm.
What did you understand the genre to be?
I don't know. I was going to ask that self same thing. I'm not entirely sure because there's an element of it that it's a kind of like a Black Mirror.
Yeah, I thought a bit Black Mirror, a bit sort of sci-fi, thriller-esque. Yeah.
But then, because there's a bit, it tells, but it's not actually that far in the future. And then I was thinking about this earlier on, that because I'm so out of date with technology, I don't know if this is actually real or imagined or not. So this could be some sort of Black Mirror sort of future tech type thing, or it could be something that's already out there, and I don't know. It could be living in a dystopian future, and I wouldn't know about it.
Yeah, it sounds like the kind of thing where a situation is beginning to spiral out of someone's control, isn't it? It's the whole data double, especially the fact that it starts with a lie. Do you know what I mean? It starts with her signing into it. There's a line when she decides to go ahead and use it. It says, one day she gave in. She rushed past all the caveats about autonomy, jurisdictions and legal responsibilities. Yes. It's like, oh, don't do that.
But it's all done with like good intentions, isn't it? That's the thing. It's sort of, you know, it's not done with any maliciousness or anything, but you can see how it's quickly going to spiral. And bad things are going to happen, I reckon.
Also, I was thinking, we don't know for sure how Erin died.
No.
There's a bit of a question mark over that, maybe.
Was she killed by her virtual self somehow? I don't know how that would work, but it could be possible, couldn't it?
The robots killed her, yeah.
The robots come to life and killed its other self.
Yeah.
That's probably not true.
But it's good. It's good and intriguing, and she gets right into it, doesn't she, from the get-go?
Yeah. I like it when someone's dead right at the start.
She's only like two lines in when you find out.
Yeah, but straight away. Yeah, someone's dead. Right, we don't have to fanny about. Get in there with a good death.
That's it. Why are they dead? What's happened and who did it? Yeah. And you're kind of straight in.
Yeah.
I was going to say, so do you think Erin was murdered then? Because she didn't sound that nice, really. She sounded quite charismatic and like could drag people along with her. She wasn't very nice,
was she?
A little
bit flaky.
Like kind of promising pay rises, but never really, like treating people a bit like dog's bodies.
Yeah. I wonder if there is the sort of, what's it called? Like Devil Wears Prada sort of element.
Go on. I haven't seen that, so I don't know what you're saying.
Oh, well, she was not like a particularly nice lady, the boss. But, you know, it turns out that she was... I don't know, I can't remember. I don't know why I started that. I can't really remember.
But
I think there is a parallel. There is a parallel somewhere.
It could be. Is it like this thing that I can't quite remember what that was like
probably,
in itself?
Is,
yeah.
It could be.
It might be it a bit like
be.
That, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it probably is very similar to that. Mm-hmm.
I've got a helpful criticism. I wanted to know what form the data double took, if that makes sense. Like, how does it work? Do you know what I mean? There was no sort of explanation of what it...
Is it like
I almost
Crichton
wanted it to,
from Red
yeah,
Dwarf?
Like I wanted it to have almost its own personality.
Was it a physical robot, or was it just a hologram, or was it just on a computer?
Yeah.
Or,
is it like a
so
CGI,
how could it interact with the world?
AI version of her on the screen that you can talk to and ask them, you know, to do stuff for you, or what? And does she reply using the same kind of language?
Is
or?
It like a little paperclip?
Yeah, paperclip that pops up and says, can
Erin
I help you?
It's dressed as a paperclip.
Yeah, that's how I imagined it.
But I fancied a bit more of the kind of nuts and bolts of how it is formed.
In terms of the story, I think it probably would be good to know, wouldn't it? Knowing how that can interact with this world and the people.
Yeah, we just visualise it better, don't you?
Well, even just knowing that if it's housed in a robot... Yeah. body of something, then it could actually be responsible for the death. Or if it's just a chat on a phone screen, then it's not. But it just kind of sets where it is in the story as a character, doesn't it? I
guess. But that's the only bit that where you kind of left a little bit floundering. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Data double. What do you mean? What does it do? Yeah.
You would assume that as it is called data double, and quite a strong bit of the plot is about the data double, that at some point there will
it's
be
quite good to have it
more of a description
early on, isn't it?
Of what a data double is. I would imagine that's coming. Yeah.
Anyone have any other little helpful criticism?
No, I was trying to think of something that we could say that would make Madeline cry, but I haven't really...
Oh, I've got something.
Go on.
Madeline, you need to watch your tenses. There's a couple of tense switches. You are in present tense and then you flip to... past tense, and then you flip back to present tense, and then I think you flip back to past tense again. It just jars a
maybe
little bit.
Maybe there's a time travel element to the story.
Maybe that comes in later.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. But anyway, just have a look at that. Have a little look. Probably doesn't bother some people, but it's one of those.
It bothers you, John, clearly. Things. Otherwise, you wouldn't have mentioned
Bloody
it,
does.
Would you?
Bloody
so,
does.
Yeah. Rightly so.
But hopefully that's made you cry and you're feeling...
or
you know.
is it either it has made you cry... Or it is making you cry. Pick one.
But yeah, we really liked it. Hopefully that will stop you crying now. But we,
enjoyed it. Yeah,
it's a good story. Mm-hmm.
It was engaging.
Although if you have quit your day job, as you said, to write that, and that is all you've got so far, definitely write some more.
That's probably not enough.
No, that's not going to. It's good, but that's probably not going to pay the bills on its own. So yeah.
Did you see, by the way, speaking of people carrying on writing, did you see we got an email from our old mate, Craig Margolis?
Craig Margolis, yes.
Yes, he sent us a new version of the opening of his novel, if you remember.
I didn't like this email from Craig, yeah.
I know, it's the one we read a bit of. It's about a Jewish kid who had the misfortune of being called Adolf. Well, Craig has written to us and he said, I wanted to pass along a much revised version of the same work I sent last year. You may remember you advised me to cut away all the background in the front to get to the story.
That's what I'm doing. What are you doing, Craig?
He lost his mind.
You're not supposed to listen to us. We have no idea what we're talking about.
You meant to say, I heard what you said and I've done exactly the opposite because I want this to be a success. Yes. I want to get published. I want it to be successful.
But, we'll have to have a little read of that and see.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to read it.
If it is.
Knowing that, I'm not sure I want to.
It'd be good. It would be really good for us to read it and then just send him an email back saying, nah, it was better the way it was before. Yeah. Hope we haven't wasted a lot of time rewriting that. But yeah, no, we were wrong. We were completely wrong. We were just saying whatever. Yeah, no, it's better like that.
Yeah.
Let's go and try and be more positive about our writing.
Yes. Yeah. We can't have another downbeat.
No, we
week,
do.
Chaps.
I don't know how you do that. How do you do that?
You just got to break through, haven't you? You just got to stare at the screen until something happens.
Until
you can unclog your finger holes.
Yeah. Sometimes you've just got to force yourself to enjoy yourself.
Smile until you smile.
Fake it until you break it.
Well, I don't know about you, Charles, but I'm already feeling better, so that's a good sign.
No, not good. Really.
So, let's leave everyone...
On a high. Let's leave on a high.
Let's leave everyone there and say thanks for listening, everybody. And, crack on with your writing. And I'm sure your writing is a lot more...
Don't be like us. See you again soon.
Bye.
See ya.
I think there's a massive delay, isn't there, every time I speak? Yes, there is. Yes, because I can tell.
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?